This is January 6, 2026. We are in Natick, Massachusetts, and this tape is part of the Morse Institute Library's continuing Veterans Oral History Project. My name is Maureen Sullivan. We are privileged to have with us today David Brandel. Welcome, David.
Hello.
May I ask when you were born?
So I was born October 22nd, 1987.
And where were you born?
Johnson City, Tennessee.
What community do you currently live in?
I currently live in Natick, Massachusetts.
Your marital status?
I'm married.
And do you have children?
Yeah, I have one daughter.
Okay. So I understand that you spent a few years in Tennessee and then you moved to North Carolina.
Yep, that's correct.
And so tell us about your childhood.
Just let me know if I get too long-winded.
Okay, don't worry.
So I was the youngest of four boys, so there are six people in my family. We moved to North Carolina when I was about 6 years old. Suburban kind of lifestyle. I was all my brothers very smart, straight-A students. I was a straight-A student, but I definitely had, I felt like I was a little bit of a black sheep in the family. But we all did really well in kind of our primary education. We all were able to get into University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Some of us on some academic scholarships, and then also like growing up as kids, we played sports, baseball. I did a little bit of running as a kid, just community teams. But we weren't on any like teams for the high school. And we were really big into music though. So we did marching band, which is much bigger down there than it is up here. And when we went to college though, it was much more academic focused. And that's when I tried out this thing called ROTC in college. My brother had tried it out for a little bit. He was 2 years older than me. He was at university the same time I was. And I enjoyed it. The leadership aspects of it is kind of what tied me into it. And having that conversation with my parents about joining the military, because my family isn't a military family, was interesting, to say the least. But yeah, that was kind of my upbringing, just suburban, did good in school, mm-hmm. went to college. That was kind of the expectation.
Okay, so what was your major at UNC?
Computer science. So I have a Bachelor of Science in Computer Science.
Okay. And of course, you stuck in ROTC.
Yeah, I tried it out, so I don't know if it's changed, but back then you can kind of do the first 2 years. You don't get a scholarship or anything, but you can kind of try out mm-hmm. like a club sport. You can take some classes in it too, and they count it as credit hours. And so I was just trying it out, and they had a thing called Ranger Challenge, which is like a competitive aspect of ROTC. So obstacle courses, some physical training, land navigation in the woods. There's also land navigation in the woods. There was like hand grenade courses and shooting courses. So all those types of things as a, 19-year-old, I was like, yeah, I want to try that, especially if it's, I don't have to sign up for the Army and I can just kind of try it out. And I did it, and all those things were very fun, but it was like the leadership aspect. So it was you and your peers and leading them through phases of a mission or an operation or training event. And I had a knack for it. I enjoyed it. It was challenging. It was harder than some of the academic things I did growing up in school. That was very rote and easy. I think that was like the hook that got me. And I said, well, what if I just try this thing? And actually part of the reason, I think part of that was, again, three older brothers, that time frame. So I was in college from 2006 to 2010. My oldest brother was pursuing his PhD in physics and was having a rough go at it, trying to find a job afterwards. And then my second oldest brother was like struggling to get his PhD also in physics. Like I said, they were very smart. And then my closest brother graduated 2008, right during the, it was a rough job market, and he was kind of just struggling to find my way. So there I am, also around 2008, seeing kind of what my brothers had been following in their footsteps, went to the same high school, went to the same university. And I was getting a computer science degree. I knew I'd be fine with that degree. I was doing well in that. but the idea of a cubicle in an office, this was just me thinking through it. I was much more wise, I guess, young, back then, but that wasn't going to go away. I could always do that. So I said, well, what if I did this? And I got the information, which for me, as a non-scholarship ROTC participant, it would be a 3-year commitment plus another 5 inactive or in the reserve force. And that seemed, okay, well, I can do, I did middle school for 3 years. I did high school for 4 years. I think I can do this thing in my period of life for 3 or 4 years if I wanted to on my own accord. So that's when I kind of decided, I'm good at this, I like it, it's a passion, I'm not gonna cripple my own potential career growth down the line. And if I like it, I can keep doing it. If I don't like it, you know, I can get out at that point. So I decided to go through with it in right around 2008, 2009 is when I fully contracted. And that kind of set me on that path.
So you did get out of UNC 2010.
Yes.
And you did receive a commission.
Yes.
What happened next?
Yeah. So actually in that final year, I also joined the North Carolina National Guard because I kind of realized I didn't have, I was meeting a lot of other people who had actual experiences with the military, either prior service doing ROTC or people whose family members, brothers, sisters, uncles, fathers, mothers were in the Army. And I kind of realized like that, I didn't have that level of just depth and knowledge and experience. So I joined the National Guard in a simultaneous membership program. So I was both in ROTC, in college, getting my degree and doing the National Guard to just get some experience. I got to go to airborne school. So that when I did commission in 2010, I had some reps and sets and experience working, like how does the real Army work? Because ROTC is not the real Army. How's the enlisted and officer, NCO, warrant officer kind of world kind of work. And I'm glad I did. So I commissioned in May of 2010, graduated and commissioned within 24 hours. And then within, I want to say it was about 2 weeks, I was reporting into Fort Lewis, Washington, way out west, and drove cross country with everything I owned, which wasn't a lot. It was in a 2-door car. Just driving across country to report into Fort Lewis, Washington, where I worked actually as cadre. I was a second lieutenant. I hadn't gone through any officer training outside of ROTC, and I was working as cadre for cadet training for the summer. So I did that for about 60 days with another group of people just like me. They had just graduated. They were out there. So I was with a bunch of very good second lieutenants who were going to go into different branches. I was going to be an engineer. And then a smaller subset of us all went from the Seattle area, Tacoma, to Missouri, Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, to go do our basic officer training, where we were going to go train to be engineer officers. So it was nice because when I arrived, there were some people who were just arriving. They had 3 months, 4 months since their graduation. And I don't know what they did, living at home with their parents, got a part-time job, I'm not exactly sure, but they had to wait around. I was able to kind of expedite it by graduating, packing my car, driving, reporting, working with lieutenants in the Army and real officers and NCOs and soldiers, going to Fort Leonard with a core group. So we kind of already had this core group of friends that we all worked together, pushed each other, and we did our training. So I want to say that was like October roughly of 2010, and then I want to say it ended, it was right before St. Patrick's Day is when it ended in 2011. I got to do a follow, and during that time frame, so from October to March, so that 6-month time frame, I had my orders for Alaska, and I was going to go to the 1st Brigade 25th Infantry Division. It was a striker brigade. And I already had been contacted by my commander and a sponsor, and they told me, hey, we're deploying. We're deploying in May. So I was going to graduate in, I guess it was March, and I was going to be deploying as early as May. And they said, these are the follow-on schools, so the schools after my basic officer training. If you can get these ones, do it. If they offer you other ones, don't do it. It's not going to matter. And I was able to get one of those. It was called EOCA, Engineer Ordnance Clearance Agent. I don't remember exactly what it stands for, EOCA. And they teach you more about munitions and how to blow them up, blow in place. So I did that for 2 weeks. Not to get derailed too much, but in that time, there was St. Patrick's Day weekend between my graduation and starting that course. That's actually when I met my wife, was during that weekend. It was my girlfriend at the time, but that's when I met her, was actually in that split. So then I did this Explosive Ordnance Clearance Agent course and graduated. It was 2 weeks, went up to Alaska. I flew up to Alaska, shipped my car, shipped my household goods, which was really not much, because I was kind of living on base at the time. And I was there for a little bit of in processing. The first time I met my unit was actually at their family day going away to deploy. And then within the next 2 weeks, the majority of the unit was already deploying on main bodies. And then I was on a plane almost to the day, 1 year after my college graduation. I was on a plane headed to Manas, Kyrgyzstan, the air base, and then I was flying into Kandahar. Almost 1 year exactly for my graduation.
Boy, you were kept busy.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, so you wait to go by your wife.
It was girlfriend at the time, but
okay,
yeah.
Okay, girlfriend, wife, and then you probably got a quick spot of Alaska. Now you're in Kandahar. Tell us what happened.
Oh, yeah. So I didn't really know my unit, as I kind of previously mentioned. I knew a couple people, my sponsor, some other people that I was told to travel with, and everyone else knew everyone else on the plane. So I was just following everyone. I knew ranks, so I just kind of followed certain ranks around. I went to the formations that we had, and we landed in Kandahar, and everyone knew where to go. They all had people coming to like pick them up. So you're on an airbase, which is a very large airbase in Afghanistan. I have my M16 because they didn't have any M4s left to hand me. So I have my old M16. I don't have any night vision, but I have my issued deployment equipment, and I'm sitting there at the airbase. I land in Kandahar, or it's Kandahar Airfield, CAF, if you hear me say that. And it's like, okay, what next? Well, this is 2011. We don't have like global cell phone plans. It's Afghanistan. It's a war zone. So I'm trying to figure out, how do I get in contact with some of the people I had met? How do I figure out where my unit is? So that was an interesting thing. Luckily, again, there's a lot of luck on my side, is I had a friend who went to the USO from college. So she was actually in Kandahar. So I was able to link up with her. She'd been in Afghanistan a little bit longer as a civilian volunteer working for the USO. So she was able to show me some of the ropes. She was able to talk to some people that she had met in her time there. They were able to help me out a little bit. And what happened was that I actually saw a striker that had engineer implements. So the strikers, there's an engineer variant, and only the engineer variants have these like mine plow specific kind of like implements on the front of them. And I was able to flag them down. We're on an airbase in Afghanistan. I'm trying to flag them down. And I recognized one of the NCOs because he was in a similar course right before deployment. I said, hey, it's, you know, Lieutenant Brandle. We met in Fort Laramie. He's like, oh. I was like, can you help me figure out where you guys are? How do I get to you and everything else? And he was able to tell me what airbase they were at. He said that he was going to radio in that I was here because the unit wasn't tracking that I'd already arrived. And I was able to use that information to go to the PAX terminal on the airfield and catch a helicopter from Kandahar Airfield to FOB Logman, which is where we were, is further north, which is where our battalion and company headquarters was. So I was able to get on one, and they just told me when to arrive with all my bags and everything else. And I just, again, no night vision, is flying at night. Everyone else has NODs. The guns, I think it was a UH-60, it might have been a Chinook, but they were shooting on parts of our way out. I couldn't see anything. I had no idea. But everything goes fine. We land on the airfield. It's still nighttime. So now I'm on a smaller base that doesn't have as much life support. Again, everyone else that was there with me, they had escorts coming and picking them up. And I just remember thinking, okay, well, I can see the silhouettes of radios and like the antennas, and I'm just going to go to the one with the most antennas because that's some sort of headquarters CP, and I'm just going to go talk to a person and figure it out. And that's kind of how I got and arrived at my first unit in Afghanistan as a second lieutenant. Thinking back on that, I have no idea how I didn't just become missing in action within the first week of being deployed to Afghanistan. But I think the things I'd done leading up to it, trying to expose myself to the military, just like figuring out little things that they don't teach you in textbooks and everything else, like I was able to kind of navigate and figure it out. And, and I arrived and they said, well, it's already night and we could use a night shift person. So they put me as a night shift OIC of the base defense for a couple weeks. I can keep going if you want. It keeps going.
Well, apparently you figured it well enough to make it to your base. You have your first assignment. What was your duties as a night shift person?
Yeah, so the night shift, it's the BDOC, Base Defense Operations Command. My battalion was in charge of the base defense for that small little base. So night shift, there were three of us. It was myself, an E7, and an E6. So it was a staff sergeant and a sergeant first class. And it was really just working with the sergeant of the guard and the towers. We had a very long telescoping pole that had night vision and everything else. And it was just maintaining the perimeter, things going on, making sure that when people were coming into land, like helicopters, like the one I had arrived in, like that there was someone there to greet them. I was only in that position maybe for a couple weeks because a platoon leader got relieved, an engineer platoon leader got relieved on my base. And although I wasn't supposed to get the next platoon, I was there, I was available. He got relieved pretty quickly. So they said, congratulations, you're now a platoon leader. You are second platoon leader. Here's your platoon sergeant. You guys are going out on mission tomorrow morning. So you should probably talk to him. And it was that quick. But yeah, in that role, there were some fun stories and things. We had to deal with some fires that started on the base and trying to figure that out. Luckily, all of us, the two NCOs and myself, we were all engineers, so we were actually okay with problem solving and figuring things out. Had some funny experience with the Ranger Regiment. They were doing raids around the base or in the area, and there was one day or night where they called in saying that they were going to drop off a POW or prisoner of war or a detainee. And I'm just looking at the NCOs and they're looking at me. I'm like, okay, well, what are we supposed to do? Because we had no SOP for that. And we were trying to figure out how to wake the provost marshal. Where were we going to put them? How do we do the paperwork? And I just remember that was a crazy night. They said, sir, you need to be out there to go talk to these people because you're the officer in charge, you go handle this. So I remember it was a Chinook coming out, and there was, and you could always tell who the Rangers were. One, it was the 160th SOAR, so they always had blacked out helicopters, but also their gear and equipment was so much cooler than ours. And they just kind of like handed me this prisoner, handed me some paperwork, said sign here, and then that was that. And I had this prisoner, I brought the E6 with me, and like we found the provost and said, I think this is what you need. and didn't hear anything else after that about that, but it was just, that was a weird time. Just, again, things they didn't teach you in the other courses. But yeah, within 2 weeks though, I was waking up in the morning and saying, congratulations, here's your platoon. And now you're a platoon leader of about 30 people, and here's your platoon sergeant.
And you're going on your first mission.
Yeah, yeah. It was next morning. I woke up to start my shift. I sat down with my battalion commander and my company commander, and they said, Lieutenant Brandle, there's a lot more to this, but you are now the platoon leader for 2nd Platoon. Congratulations. You probably weren't going to get a platoon for a couple more months, but it is what it is. Figure it out. Here is Sergeant First Class Medrano, Daniel Medrano. Fantastic gentleman. He was my platoon sergeant. So much attributed to him and his mentorship. So he and I sat and talked and came to an understanding. He's like, you're the platoon leader. I know that you just got here. You don't know any of the people. You don't even know what trucks. You don't know who's in the platoon. You don't know your squad leaders. We're going to get that figured out. We have to do an inventory transfer. But let's get on mission and let's just start figuring this out. So we didn't really have a lot of forming and norming kind of time, but immediately it was like, hey, I trust you. I know you. Mm-hmm. I've heard good things. But at the same time, like, I want to be able to make this my platoon, right? I don't want to just be backseating as a lieutenant. And we worked fantastically together, and we went through the remainder of that deployment. I was the platoon leader.
Glad to hear that. So you were mentioning your mission a couple of times. What exactly was it?
Yeah. So combat engineers in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. in that time frame, we were majority just doing route clearance. So route clearance operations are, you're looking for IEDs, improvised explosive devices. You're looking for roadside bombs and the things that they're digging into the ground. Afghanistan was a lot more homemade explosives than munition based. My unit had a lot of previous experience in Iraq because the surges in Iraq were the preceding years, but then now we're in Afghanistan. So it's a different fight, similar mission, but different fight, different kind of tactics and techniques. So the fact that I wasn't in Iraq, but had all this modern kind of education, plus that after that school that I went to after my basic officer course, I wouldn't say that I was a subject matter expert, but I had like the knowledge base of what we should be doing. And they'd be like, well, this is why we did it in Iraq. I was like, yeah, Iraq was like this. This is Afghanistan. They're doing this. So we were all new to Afghanistan, and we were able to work together through experience and kind of the knowledge to like figure out how are we going to tackle this mission. So we did 80% of our missions were probably route clearance, looking for IEDs. The other missions that we did were sapper missions. So we would send a squad or two out with the infantry or any of the maneuver forces, and they would be the explosives kind of experts working with the infantry. And then in addition to that, I had a couple other missions where I was an engineer officer surrounded by infantry. I was just their subject matter expert on anything engineering, which could be construction, utilities, demolition, explosives. So I had a couple missions where I was going out with civil affairs, psyops, FEST teams, female engagement teams, female engagement teams. And then I would be looking at the utilities of whatever village we were talking to, trying to figure out how are they getting water, how are they doing power, how are they doing sewage, et cetera. So that was maybe 20% of the missions that those weren't super frequent. And the other 80% was just driving on the roads in our up-armored, mine-resistant MRAPs, and just looking for IEDs.
Mm-hmm. When you were looking for IEDs, were you looking for, like, any physical evidence?
Yeah. It's, yes. So there are indicators of IEDs. And the longer you're in an area, the more you drive the same routes and roads, the more you start recognizing what's different. When you're first there and with the training they give you, they're like, yeah, they use these things, these yellow jugs. Imagine like a milk jug, but much mm-hmm. larger, maybe 5 gallons, 10 gallons, and they're yellow. And they'd use that for everything, though. They'd use it for water transportation. They cut off the tops and just carry things in it. So those were very prevalent, those types of jugs, but that was also what they would put homemade explosives in and then use that as the main charge, to carry the main charge of the homemade explosives. So they were saying, oh yeah, you're gonna run into IEDs. IEDs are usually in yellow jugs or blue jugs, but they failed to mention that like those jugs are so prevalent used because they're like used for everything there. So we were seeing blue jugs and yellow jugs everywhere when we first started, and you're freaking out. You're thinking everything's an IED, but that's not the case. But it's things that were slightly different. It was geographic kind of shapes that wouldn't necessarily appear in nature. I have a story about that, like my actual personal IED find. But it was things like that. I actually have a picture of that yellow jug in the ground as an IED. I can show you that. Mm-hmm. But it's finding things that are different. And the longer you're there and the more you know the terrain, the roads, the routes, what the roads look like, what the softness of certain shoulders look like, you really start picking up on it. And then you'd use historical data. There are certain just like we would do, there's certain areas I would want to engage and ambush a unit. Same with them. When they're targeting us, there are certain areas where they want to do that. Then the last little aspect also was the civilians around. There was very specific times where we would turn on a specific road and you would just see everyone leave the fields. And we're like, well, like that was an indicator. It's like, well, that we're, yep, there's something here. So there's things like that that we did. I mentioned the geographic shapes. So there was one, so where we were, a lot of pressure plates is how they set them off. So we would drive over something and it would initiate and blow up the main charge. We had rollers, so there were a couple times where our rollers would actually hit something and it would blow up the main charge, but it would blow up the rollers. So our truck's fine and all of our people are fine, and we would just take out the rollers, and sometimes the rollers would still work, and then put new rollers on and we keep going. And we knew that that was it was so frustrating, I'm sure, to anyone who was hoping to, you know, kill Americans, but like we're not stopping, right? We have these implements and these tools and all these other things. So what they started doing was they tried to offset where the pressure plate was to where the charge was. But in doing that, they had to dig more. So then we started finding more, or we would switch the direction of the routes we were going. So there was one time where we hit it, and then 10 feet, 20 feet in front of where our rollers were, there was the ginormous explosion, because they offset it, but they offset it not knowing which direction we were coming from. So it was a big cat and mouse game about this. The one I found was, it was a old Russian anti-personnel mine, and it was wrapped in deck cord, and then there was orange deck cord. This was all underground. It was once we dug it up, and then it was yellow jugs designed. And this was a day, I think it was in the middle of our deployment. We had a lot of people on cycle, on rest and relaxation, R&R. We were running missions 6 days a week. My guys were getting burnt. No one really wanted to be the lead truck because you're more likely to get hit. Mm-hmm. And I remember there were portions I would just take the lead truck, which is not advised as the OIC to be in the lead truck. But I was doing that on some portions of some of the missions. And I remember specifically being in my truck, and I have my driver, myself, I have my gunner. And then we may or may not have had an additional person in the truck as a dismount. And I remember we were just trying to keep their heads in the game, because you're driving so slow and it's hot and it can be anywhere from 4 to 10 hours on the road just doing this. And I was saying, if you were them, where would you put one? What would you do? And we were kind of turning it into a game in my truck. And I remember we were talking about geographic or geometric shapes, because in nature, that not everything straight lines and whatnot. And I remember saying like, yeah, like that thing in the road. And I was like, stop. And we stopped, and like we looked at it, we had some cameras and we looked at it, and we got a truck in to actually like dig at the thing that I was talking about. We threw a chem light near it, and then we talked him in, and with like these big arms, and it went in, so very long, big arms, and it went in and was able to pull up the mine that we were just talking about and I saw. And then you could see the thing kind of going back under where our truck had stopped. And then they were able to pull that out, and we blew it up. Mm-hmm. But I remember that one very specifically. I remember my gunner was like, thank you, sir. Because he was like, that one had our name on it. And I was like, yeah, trust me. I'm thanking myself as much as, like, don't worry. It wasn't selfless. I also didn't want to get blown up. But I knock on wood and everything else. I made it through that entire deployment without getting blown up, which was nice. But a lot of times things blew up in front of me. So that was always stressful. It always seemed to be the truck in front of me. Mm-hmm.
And how long was your deployment?
It's 12 months.
12 months, wow. So aside from tracking down IEDs, were you and your unit, did you ever engage the enemy in other ways?
There was one time, it was actually one of those other 20% missions where I was going out with the PsyOps team and the civil affairs team. This mission, I had so many red flags. There were so many red flags about this mission. And I remember telling both the battalion commander that I was working for, because in this time I mentioned I flew up north, we actually came back down south in a couple months, and then we were working in Panjoway, which is the Horn of Panjoway. It's where the Taliban started. It was a very dynamic, very aggressive, very explosive. There were certain roads that were guaranteed to either get shot at by small arms fire or recoilless rifles or get blown up, complex ambushes. Like, we had moved to 2 months into a very, very heavy fight. So I was doing one of those missions in a village, and I'd been in country 6, 7, 8 months at that point. So I had a pretty good understanding of the villages, the roads, the routes, where it was bad, where it wasn't bad. And I was doing this dismounted mission, and there were all these red flags about it. I had sent a lot of, I was only first lieutenant, I think, at the time. Mm-hmm. And I sent a lot of, hey, this is why I think this is a bad idea. This is how I think we should adjust this mission and still meet the intent. That's my lieutenant colonel language, not necessarily what I was saying as a lieutenant. But long story short, I guess, with this mission is we were dismounted. I had two of my sappers with us on the patrol. So it was myself, two of my sappers, and then a bunch of people that we don't usually work with. And we were coming back. It was all dismounted. And we were coming back to the base. And someone suggested that we take a shortcut through a graveyard. And I was like, we shouldn't do this. So on top of all the other things I said, we should have had engineers, U.S. engineers out there with my platoon or parts of my platoon with their mine detectors, et cetera. It was just the Afghan National Army with their mine detectors. And I don't even think half of them were on. I don't know if they knew how to use them. But we decided to take the shortcut. They were doing the sweeping. The person in front of me, who was the patrol leader, so although I was a lieutenant, there was another lieutenant who was actually the patrol leader, stepped on an IED in front of me. It was probably distance from me to maybe the corner of that wall. It low ordered because it had been raining kind of the days before, which means it didn't all blow up, but it did blow up. He went flying. So now we're in this graveyard. We're in the middle of the formation. I have people behind me who don't know what's going on. I have people in front of me who've already passed through this area now that we know has at least one IED in it. Then they're shooting. So now I'm stuck in the middle of this area, in this graveyard, where I only know the path behind me is clear. I know that something in front of me isn't clear. And I remember, and now I'm the only other lieutenant. So now I'm in charge of this, or at least I took charge of it. It didn't really matter if I was or wasn't. So there's shooting going on in front of me. I had one of my engineers in the front. I had one of my engineers in the back. And I'm shouting instructions. Our medic, who was also on the female engagement team, was not having a good time, wanted to treat, but was afraid. I had to like clear the way from where I was and she was to him to bring him back, to get him across, to get everyone through. That was the one time. I think there were other times there was small arms fire on our convoy. My platoon definitely got hit while I was out with a more complex ambush, but I can't really speak to that because I was on R&R, which was the worst feeling in the world. But that one that I'm describing was crazy. Absolute chaos. We got through it. We got him medevaced. He was fine. But that was just controlling that chaos with a unit that wasn't my unit, but just being in charge and using my engineers as more or less team leaders and squad leaders to take charge of their elements in the front and the back. It didn't really matter who was who. It didn't really matter rank at that point because we were the only ones with our heads on our shoulders. So we just took charge. And then there's the other thing that happened while I was on R&R, which unfortunately was our casualty in our platoon. This is the worst thing, to be home on R&R and get a cryptic message because they can't inform me. They're not supposed to inform until the family's informed of a casualty. And just trying to, like, it. I just wanted to get back to Afghanistan with my guys and figure out what happened and be with them. So that also happened. He lived, that guy, but he lost a leg. To a recoilless rifle. He was a gunner and he lost a leg to a recoilless rifle.
Hmm. I know it's often very difficult for someone who's been there to share their experiences, so we thank you for that. Are there any other experiences you would like to relate while you were in country?
I mean, there was so much. Yeah, I don't want to
okay.
bore
That's
everyone.
Okay.
There were a lot of things. I being with my platoon was the best thing. I know that sounds like I'm just kind of reading from a cereal box or something, but I got to know my guys. They got to know me. We learned to lean on each other, trust each other. We knew when we were off. It was long. It was a slog for 12 months to do that. It was stressful. But there's some proud moments. It was when, at the very end, when my the task force I was working with, it was 1-5 Infantry Battalion, the Bobcats. So we were the engineer platoon attached to them, and we did all their engineer things, combat engineer things. When that battalion commander, we were leaving that area, and when he specifically said, "Hey, David, hey, I'm going to be going on this convoy. Can you give me the route?" Like, he came to me to get the route clearance, which information to know if I was going to be, my platoon was going to be clearing, if we could clear some specific routes that he was going to be going on prior to. Like, that was like, okay. Like, because you don't get a lot of love driving slow and just looking for IEDs. It's not as sexy a job as the infantry. But that was a good feeling. I remember telling my guys about that. It's like, look, this guy, the guy in charge, like, he wants us. He's asking for us. He's asking for us to do our thing. So that was great. There's a thousand. I have a thousand stories of Afghanistan. I don't want to take the entire day necessarily telling them all.
No, that's okay. Did you deal with the Afghan civilians?
Not directly. Like I mentioned, we were so prevalent in the area. My translator, I had a translator. Well, I went through multiple translators, but had translators. I might have a picture. There was one time, because we're engineers, so we're driving a lot of heavy equipment. And they're just living their lives in a third world country. So there was one time where there was a truck, and I swear I have a picture somewhere of it, that was turned on its side. Let's see if I can find it. Oh, did I not? Yes, here it is. I knew I had this picture. Mm-hmm. There was this picture of this truck that went into a canal. And we kind of got stopped, waved down. So I dismounted. We set up the security. I dismounted. So that's actually me. And I'm just, and my translator isn't there yet. And they're like talking to me in Pashto. And I'm like, I don't speak. And they're like pointing to the truck. And I'm like, yeah, that truck's pretty stuck, like, looking at it. And it was just a kind of little funny moment. But they wanted help. The problem, we wanted to help them because we had big, again, we had a wrecker. Like, we had a crane, so we might have been able to pull it out. And I brought my, oh, so that was the other thing. We're engineers, but we also had two mechanics that ran our wrecker, and they were in our platoon. They became the family. It wasn't like add-ons. It wasn't attachments. They were part of our platoon. But I talked to him, and he's like, "Sir, if I try to pull this thing out," like, he's like, "look at," it was in a canal, which had water, so it was mud, and it was just stuck in this mud. He's like, I will probably rip that truck in half with the amount of rust on that truck. So there were some times we would try to help. There was one time we were on mission. I had almost forgotten about this. We were on mission. We were going back to our area after doing maintenance. And touching the mic. And there was like a vehicle crash or something happened right in front of us. And we dismounted. We helped out the civilians. My medic treated a kid. We called for medevacs. We were, without getting into the politics of it, like, we were this force that was, I don't want to call it an invading force, but we were the Americans in Afghanistan. We'd been there for already so many years. But there were like little things like the humanity of it. There was a car crash. We saw a family and a kid who were in a car crash, and like, I have a medic. We stopped, pulled security, helped out the people, triaged that, called medic. Like, so there were times like that where I was interacting. The other times it was just like, I felt bad for them, just because like, I'm in their area. They don't want us there. They don't want the Taliban, for the most part. Like, they don't want the Taliban there. They just want to live their lives and do their thing. And there was one time we were bringing back a vehicle that had gotten blown up, or part of it, and we were towing it back in that wrecker, and the wrecker broke a hydraulic line. So I'm driving through their town just spewing hydraulic. And I was like, I felt so bad. But it's like, we had to do what we had to do. We had to get out of there. And get that thing recovered. So that was kind of, I didn't really have, outside of the interpreters, I didn't really work with the civilian populations too much. The ANA, the Afghan National Army, I worked with them a good bit. It was not the best experience ever. Anytime I had to, there wasn't a lot of trust both ways, especially with the green on blue incidents where that was happening more and more, which is where they were shooting American soldiers. So we kept them in a safe bubble when we had to work with them.
So after 12 months, your deployment is over.
Yep.
Tell us what happened next.
Yeah. 12 months, deployment's over, I'm coming back. You can't give the exact time and date. We don't know it, and you're not mm-hmm. supposed to give it. And during that 12-month deployment, my girlfriend, who I had met in New Orleans on St. Patrick's Day, she moved from Texas up to Alaska, and she was a flight nurse up in Alaska. And so she was able to, I gave her like 12 hours notice, hey, I'm gonna be coming in around this time. And she was able to make it up there, so that was awesome.
So you ended up going back to Alaska.
Went back to Alaska, just kind of finish out my time with the unit. Mm-hmm. My wife, girlfriend at the time, but now wife, being there when we got off the plane was awesome, because I didn't think I was gonna go back to anyone. I didn't know anyone in Alaska. I couldn't give enough heads up to my family to try to get them to time it to come up there. And they're living their lives. I didn't want to mess with that. I'm sure they would have wanted me to, but I didn't want to. But having my Sam, my wife there, was awesome. Then I went back to Alaska, and I became the executive officer of the engineer company. So still a lieutenant, but second in command of the company. Where we did a lot of really good training. We were getting ready to go back to Afghanistan, because at that point in time, you were maybe 1 year off, 1 year on, maybe a year and a half off and a year on. Didn't know if I was necessarily going to deploy with the company, but I was probably going to deploy with the brigade, just because I still had my 3 to 4 years of service. So we were gearing up for that. We got off-ramped, and they wanted us to focus on Arctic. So this was back in 2012-13 timeframe. And there's a big push for relearning our Arctic kind of training. We're the Alaska units, so we need to be good at that. And it's funny because it's come full circle. It took 8 more years, but it's come full circle where what used to be my brigade, 1st Brigade, 25th Infantry Division, has reflagged and is now the 11th Airborne Division. 1st Brigade, 11th Airborne Division, and it's a pure Arctic thing. So it's funny to see the groundwork of what is now in place. It started right there when they off-ramped us off that deployment. They said, no, we need you focusing on this type of specific mission set. So I was a company executive officer. I did that for about a year. And then I actually worked at a schoolhouse in Alaska, an Army schoolhouse called the Northern Warfare Training Center, where they taught cold weather and mountain warfare. So we brought soldiers in, both from Alaska, but also from the rest of the force. And we were just teaching them cold weather survival, cold weather movement, cold weather tactics, because it's very different, and then also mountain tactics, high angle shooting, how to traverse mountain terrain, etc. We teach the basic mountaineering course. So I was a pseudo instructor. I say pseudo because I wasn't, all the instructors were NCOs, but I was one of the three or four officers in that unit, teaching classes, running classes, supporting classes. It was the coolest job you could ever have, in the Army or not. Getting paid to ride ATVs, ride snowmobiles, ice climb, rock climb, which were all passions and hobbies I had anyway. Rappelling, and I got to teach that to other people for military, but it was a hobby of mine. We had our own ski hill in Black Rapids, so when classes were over or when we were getting ready for class and we didn't have students, we would take snowmobiles and we would ski jor up to the top and then we'd ski down. And that's just what we did as the instructors to blow off steam. It was the coolest job. And I have some really great pictures of that. It was a lot of fun. But that kind of finished out my time in the Army. I had a short stint where I thought I'd do more time in the active duty Army. I was gonna try to go Special Forces. I went to selection. And kind of in that window of time was when I was like, you know what? I always said this was just a short little thing. I had married my wife at the time. We were talking about having kids. The the Special Forces kind of pipeline wouldn't be super conducive to the other things I wanted to do in my life. So that was, you know, one of those what ifs, not necessarily regrets, because I think I definitely made the right choice. Could have been a different path that my life could have taken, potentially. But I was like, you know what, I'm going to get out, and that's going to be that. I already had the coolest job in the Army. so I finished out my time in Alaska in a staff position while I out-processed from the Army. And that was 2014,
okay. Did after Alaska, were you in the reserves for?
So I took a year off. Mm-hmm. I actually got out and was working a normal person job. I was a project manager, which is the easiest transition job for any Army officer out there. I was just working a normal job. My wife actually approached me and she said, "You need a hobby," because I had too much kind of angst or too much energy or something. Mm-hmm. And I was working out and doing other things, but she said, "You need a hobby." And I mentioned the Army Reserve, mostly because, like, you can take the soldier out of the Army, but you can't take the Army out of the soldier type of thing. I was good at it. I liked it. My normal job, I wasn't getting something. The leadership aspect that kind of drew me to it, there wasn't any of that. So I took about a year off between active duty and then joining the Army Reserve. I didn't go National Guard. That was a very conscious decision. I'd done the National Guard in college, and it was a little too political, and I didn't want to go into that. And we also didn't know, we were living again in North Carolina at the time. We got out while my wife was going to school, living in North Carolina. I didn't know if I wanted to stay in North Carolina. I'd already done the North Carolina National Guard. I kind of knew how it worked. So I went the reserve side. So instead of National Guard, I went Army Reserve. And there was a new unit that was standing up right near where we lived. So I thought that would be a challenge, a brand new Army Reserve unit. And it was. And so I kind of took it because of the challenge, I think. Kind of sold me on it. I think that would scare some other people if they're just looking for a chill job. But I was like, oh, this is going to be hard. And I have all this 4 years prior. If I can do that, I could probably work in an Army Reserve job and help them out.
And while you were in the reserves, did your computer science kick in?
No. I tried to keep the digital systems of the DOD and the Army, there's so many rules and regulations, and it's very locked down unless you have certain permissions. I tried to make sure they didn't know that I even had a computer science degree. That makes sense. I wanted to do the Army, the engineer things. I didn't want to go cyber, which wasn't even a thing when I first went in. I didn't want to go into the Signal Corps or switch branches. I wanted to keep those two separate. It worked very well for me to be able to keep those two separated. Mm-hmm. It not until more recently am I considering maybe trying to do something combined. But I stayed engineer. I was a company commander in the Army Reserve. Trained my company for a mission in Guatemala. Mm-hmm. They did a couple weeks in Guatemala building and improving schools in Guatemala. And then they had to turn around and immediately deploy to Africa. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to deploy with them. I was getting promoted to major. There were other captains that needed command time. So that was hard, but I was able to work with them. It's not fun to train your unit, right? You don't want to just do spring training and never play the game. But I had enough time in the Army to know it's just how it works sometimes. So I did the best I could to just get them prepared and get that new commander as spun up as possible. I think she did a great job with that. She had a quick turnaround. She landed, went to Guatemala, kind of like me in Afghanistan. She landed, kind of had to go to Guatemala with everything I prepared for the unit for her. And then she had to immediately turn that around and go to Africa for 9 months. And she did a great job. So I did company command as an engineer. It was a construction company. Did that. That was also in the window of time where I moved up to Boston. So I was flying from Boston down to Virginia once a month doing that. And then I became a battalion, skipping some jobs, but I became a battalion XO, actually of that same battalion that I stood up. So I got voluntold to go be the battalion executive officer of that battalion, and they were deploying. So I trained the staff, the battalion staff, worked with my battalion commanders. I had two of them in that window of time. Mm-hmm. And we deployed to the Middle East in 2021. I think it was 2021 to 2022. It might have been 2022 to 2023. It was 2022 to 2023 because it was after COVID, a good bit after COVID. So I was a battalion executive officer of an engineer battalion. We deployed our headquarters and forward support. We got in country, we got an additional five companies. We were a very large battalion. We were 770 people, seven companies, and we were the only, at that time, the only engineer battalion in the Middle East. So CENTCOM as a whole, if there was Army engineering required, it was coming from our battalion. So we were operating in Syria, Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Jordan. We sent some missions, or we had some things going on in, I think, Dubai, UAE, or United Arab Emirates. So that was an interesting job. I think it came at a good time for myself personally. I was a lot more mature. I was a lot older. I was a battalion executive officer, bigger formation. Had a really good commander, really good sergeant major. And we all had a lot of active duty experience, but a lot of our people, the 700 people with us, this was their first deployments. They'd only done reserve time. So it was our job to get them ready, but then also like get them through 9 months without it becoming an issue. And we did a fantastic job. We did great things. We kind of changed a little bit how engineers were working in theater at that time. I became the czar of Jordan was our joke. So I was in charge of just figuring out the engineer, army engineer side of Jordan, how to move people in, equipment, how should it pour it in. And we became like the little battalion that could, like the Thomas the Tank Engine there, because we were the only ones. We had one brigade, they only had one battalion. And then after that, it was the division which owned the parts of that theater. And we wanted to get after it. And they were willing to say yes, as long as we had good enough reasoning and did the paperwork. So we did the paperwork and we did great things. So that was out to 2023. And as a reservist and came home, that was a lot easier to deploy and come home from. It was hard on the deployment because I had a kid versus when I was single, but it wasn't looking for IEDs. That wasn't a year of it. So it was much more construction. No one shot at me. No one tried to blow me up. So that was great. I didn't have to go to bunker during that time frame when I was in Iraq. So I saw most of those countries and flew around a lot.
So you were deployed to the Middle East for how long?
9 months.
9 months. So 2023.
Yep.
And then what happened after that?
Yeah, after that I needed a knee. I needed to take a knee. So I found a job, which is my current position now. I'm still in this role. It's called the Contingency Response Unit, CRU. It sounds a lot crazier than it really is. It is direct support to the Army Corps of Engineers from a reserve side, but we also help geographic combatant commanders with engineer staff work. So our unit is senior captains and above. So a couple senior captains, majors, lieutenant colonels. Our commander is a Fulberg colonel. The NCOs we have are all E8s, so master sergeants. Mm-hmm. Except for our sergeant major. It's about 50 people, and we participate in training events, big training events around. In this unit, I've gotten the opportunity to go to South Korea and participate in one of the Freedom Shields. I went to Germany, where I was participating in one of the Steadfast Deterrence. It was a NATO exercise. And you are doing work and briefing 2 stars, 3 stars, 4-star generals, like actual combatant commanders, and interacting with them. So it's and you are the engineer expert. You're working with some of the full-time staff, but they don't have a lot of full-time staff to begin with, and they don't have a lot of full-time staff that have to do real world and training. So you're able to augment that. And if a real contingency were to kick off, that's how it would work, is we would fall in with those full-time on active duty orders and work with them. So. It's been great because I get to see the other side of the Army engineers, which is the core of engineers. It's much more construction oriented, project management, big picture thing. So I'm getting to see that kind of later in my Army career. And so it's been fun. It works better with the family too.
Okay. So quick recap, you're still in the reserves, correct?
I am still in the reserves, yes.
And you're a major?
I am a lieutenant colonel.
So ooh, lieutenant colonel.
Yep, got promoted a couple months ago.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
So let's talk, tell us about some of the commendations and or medals you've received so far.
So I'll just go with badges. So I'll try to go with badges. So I got my airborne wings when I was still a cadet. I went to airborne school in 2009. Then I guess the next one would have been my combat action badge in Afghanistan. So that's engaging with the enemy. So I got a combat action badge. I got a bronze star from that deployment. I have a couple Army achievement medals, maybe one. Those are a little bit harder to get. The more rank you get, it's just kind of expected. I have a couple Army commendation medals from positions. I think command was one and one of my other jobs. So those are kind of the commendations. I have all the things that went with the deployments, the overseas ribbons, the global war on terror, expeditionary in service. I have the Afghan campaign with service stars. So I have kind of those. Pathfinder, so I went to Pathfinder school and did Pathfinder things. So yeah, those are, that's a number of them.
Okay.
There's some other ones, the other fruit salad that they kind of give out just for like being in long enough. But those are the ones that like were four things that I did.
Okay. And I know you're still in reserves, but have you had need of any services offered through the VA?
Yeah. The first time I didn't when I first got out, and it wasn't, so I got out in 2014, and then I didn't until really COVID, actually. So through the VA, veterans were able to get COVID shots, and I was a 30-something-year-old during COVID, healthy, didn't really have any medical complications, so like I was last on the list to get a vaccine, and I wanted one. So I actually went through the VA and kind of went that route, and that was my first interaction with them, and it was very positive. And then after that, after my second deployment to the Middle East as a major, when I came back, I did my full VA disability. So I had all the stuff from my previous active duty time, plus the stuff, and it wasn't a lot, but it was little things. So I received VA disability. I use my own primary care, but I know that I always have that kind of backstop if I ever needed it or was having issues. So that's kind of what I'm using it for. The two other benefits is the VA home loan. Use that, love it. Harder in Boston proper than outside because of most of the houses aren't single family. Yeah, they're condos, and then you need like meeting minutes. And anyway, so but it's a great benefit. And then the final one, which is why I'm aside from the fact that maybe I want to hit 20 years, is the GI Bill. So I forgot to. I didn't make it transferable until I came back in 2023. And that now I owe 4 years to complete that transferability because I want it for my daughter. Or I want it to be eligible for my daughter. So I have until March of 27, not that anyone's counting, but March of 27 is when that's her GI Bill to use. She can use that and go to school on the GI Bill, which is awesome.
It is.
And then, if I hit 20 years, then the final little bit there is when I turn 60, I'm still young, I'm 38 right now, but when I turn 60, I'll have those kind of healthcare benefits. So those are kind of, you know, my interaction with the VA, I don't need them as much as I think some others do. Luckily, I don't have a Purple Heart, right? I wasn't injured necessarily directly by enemy. And so I'm able to, I'm doing okay, but there's these little side benefits. And then I think the most important thing for me is this backstop, which is the VA. If things go very, very poorly, I'm in the system, I know how to talk to them, and there's a very nice safety net backstop that I can use them for.
Okay. So, David, we're getting close to wrapping things up. How important was it for you to serve in the military?
Instrumental, foundational. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be the person I am if, mm-hmm. Looking back, and my family sees it because I haven't been around my family for much of my military career. The family I grew up with, not my wife and kid. I'm a different person, probably better, probably worse in some aspects, but it's who I am. The idea of team sports, my daughter's school has this saying, and I think it's one of the best sayings: if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And I think the Army, I didn't really think that way before. And I think that's a good, looking back on my time in the Army, is just like the idea that you can get a group of people to do the hardest, easiest, craziest, whatever missions, and ask them to do it. Like, how you get that to be successful, it's not easy, and it's not something you can teach in textbooks. And so for me, I'm glad I did the Army. It shaped me because, like, those are the things I like to do, not because they're easy, but because they're hard. And it influenced how I think about things. I'm not going to lose my mind over small little things. I'm going to learn to prioritize. I'm going to learn how to think through stressful situations. And I've lived in it so much that it's just become a part of me.
Okay. So, David, is there anything you would like to add?
I know everyone's like, thanks veterans for their service, and I appreciate it. I just want to thank also like all the people who make that happen, who make it possible. So obviously my wife and my kid, but then it's all the mentors and people who helped me and got me to where I am. My platoon sergeant, Daniel Medrano, who's a retired sergeant major. He retired. He's teaching or helping out at a university right now. I definitely want to thank him. My peers, friends, Stephen Paniotti, who was lieutenant with me in Afghanistan, and then was the more or less my best man at my wedding. I was best man at his wedding. But like, I was able to, he was going through a similar path as me, and we learned from each other, and I think that was instrumental. And then the last one I definitely want to call is Colonel Hill, James D. Hill. He was my battalion commander in Kuwait, and he's the one who was like, there is no ceiling. He's like, Brandel, you have energy, you have ideas, you have a way to make, he's like, there is no ceiling. Don't be like, I don't know if I should, just do it. And him releasing that potential later on in my career when I was like, I already thought I was bogged down. So I want to thank him too for that. So that's my last little bit, is thanking all the people that are making it so that I can keep doing this. And me doing this is me giving back. So, yeah.
Well, David Brandel, thank you so much for taking part in the Natick Veterans Oral History Project.
Thank you.